Well, hello and welcome to the Profit Express. I am Tim Healy, and you are invited to join me each week as we have some amazing experts, entrepreneurs, and industry leaders share their expertise with you, all so you can win the battle for business each and every day, and we do it right here in the Profit Express. So thanks for being on board. Thanks for listening, sharing some of your time with me today. Now, while you're on Facebook, you can follow me and the show at the Profit Express page. Give us a like, a thumbs up. Let us know what you thought about today's show. Guests you'd love to hear on the show. And you can also follow me and the show on Twitter at Radio Tim Healy. It's at Radio Tim Healy. Now, let me ask you, when was the last time you tested your boundaries as a startup or an entrepreneur? Now, while you might be thinking, oh, I'm working my tail off every day, you might not be really testing who you are as an individual or a business owner. Is any of us really capable of realizing our potential in business unless we are truly willing to test our boundaries? Now, testing our boundaries in business comes when things are tough, when deals are lost, when employees quit and banks say no. Now, how will you respond when the time comes? To prepare you to win the battle for business each and every day, I want to help you be prepared for when you are met with adversity, for when you are met with challenges, so you'll be ready to shatter your boundaries. And to help me tackle the topic, I've invited on an expert in knowing how to push oneself beyond their boundaries. And he is, of course, a New York Times bestselling author, an accomplished endurance athlete, and former member of the Navy SEAL Team 6. And he was twice captured by enemy forces. And he's back on the show. He is Don Mann. And Don and I will be discussing his new book, Reaching Beyond Boundaries, a Navy SEAL's guide to achieving everything you ever imagined. Now, from my opinion, I read the book, and let me say it is a reality check. It is an eye-opener for anybody who reads it to creating an awareness as to how much untapped potential you really have. And again, that book, Reaching Beyond Boundaries, he's back on the show. It's a pleasure. Mr. Don Mann, how are you today, Don?
I'm fine, thanks, Tim, and thanks for having me on your show.
No, my pleasure. Again, great read, the stories you share of other really successful people in business, in the performance world, your own personal stories, being a Navy SEAL, being an ultra-endurance athlete. I just... Every time we've had previous conversations, I read your book. I tell you, it gets the hairs on the back of my neck standing up. It gets me excited for what I have yet to achieve. Really, I mean that.
Well, thanks. You know, I've written a number of books, and I've enjoyed the process of writing all the books I've done. But this one here is by far my favorite of them all.
Really?
And mainly, it's because, you know, it's taken a number of years to pretty much digest how a mindset can be developed and how it's helped me, but more importantly, how it's helped others that I respect a great deal. And so I've been going around the country for about 20 years or so discussing mindset and how to develop a stronger mindset, if it is business or sports or being a father or a mother or a piano player, whatever it is you do to have a stronger mindset. But to put that beyond just a one-hour talk, and to be able to put it in a book was a real pleasure for me to do. And mainly because I got to correspond with all these great people who motivated me all my life.
Absolutely. And we're going to get into some of those people. Now, obviously, a big part of your background, Navy SEAL, of course. And one of the things, I like to jump into this part of the book that you speak of, is the combat mindset. Now, again, people who are listening, you know, they might not have served. So how can a non-military, a non-SEAL, apply that combat mindset? What is it and how can they use it?
Well, you know, years ago, my talk used to be called the combat mindset, and I changed it. You know, some people are pro-military, some are neutral military, some are opposed to the military. But either way, the word combat mindset, I think, sometimes set off a different meaning than what I intended for it to be.
Okay.
In the SEAL teams, we call the subject combat mindset. But basically, it could be called a strong mindset, a powerful mindset, whatever you want to call it. But what it really entitles, what it entails is having the mindset that you can do anything in the world you put your mind to doing. And just to believe that, even if you don't necessarily get to that top, what I call macro goal, reaching all the micro goals along the way to get to the top, you might find yourself way, way above any place you would have been if you hadn't tried reaching that super macro goal. And that's what I call combat mindset. And combat mindset in the SEAL teams would give a guy a K-bar and a knife and would say, go conquer the world. And this guy, because of his mindset, because of that great SEAL training he receives, he will go out and he'll do anything he can because he knows he's going to win. And that mindset works in the SEAL teams, but that same mindset can go toward anybody, military, non-military, government, business, professional, medical, student, athlete. And it just really can translate to any profession or hobby.
Well, and you know, it kind of reminds me, I think it was, I'm kind of paraphrasing, if I get it wrong, excuse me. One of the sayings in the SEALs is, was it train like you fight and fight like you train?
Right. Yep. And we say that all the time in the SEAL community, is you don't want to say, well, in combat I would have done this, or in combat I would have taken the extra step and would have done this. We don't do it that way. And training, well, actually, we make training, hopefully, if we're successful, and as a training officer at a couple of SEAL teams, SEAL Team 2 and SEAL Team 6, what we try to do is make the training so it's much, much harder and much more challenging than the real missions would be, minus the being shot at and being, you know, rockets and missiles going at you.
Right.
But what we did, for instance, the Bin Laden raid, I was a training officer at SEAL Team 6 when I left. But that was a couple of years before the raid. When the raid took place, the guys came back, and I was told training was never that easy. We were basically, we had a helicopter go down. We basically had some small arms fire down below. We went upstairs. We took out Bin Laden. It basically wasn't any more difficult than any of the training scenarios we've been receiving all of our careers in the SEAL teams. And so in the SEAL teams, we have a saying, the more sweat and tears you put in the training, the less bloodshed in wartime.
Right.
So in the SEAL teams and in some other military units, you put everything you have in the training, make it as realistic as possible, make it harder than the mission. And when the mission takes place, boom, that wasn't so bad. Except for the only exception you can't replace is the actual fire that comes back at you in a real mission.
Sure, sure. So now that we're talking about missions, one of the missions in your book, and the story really caught my attention, it was a mission in Central America, and you referred to two other colleagues. One was Greg, and one was, I think it was Bill. Right. And yeah. I was kind of surprised, as you told the story, Greg had compromised the mission, and you, along with the second colleague, Billy, found yourselves running for your life, essentially. You end up getting captured. You end up being put in jail in Central America. And Greg ended cracking under pressure and to the point of weeping. So how do you as a SEAL in that moment, how do you respond when a team member cracks like that?
Okay, so, and I am vague when I discuss that those few days that happened down there.
Sure.
I am vague because it hasn't been declassified, it hasn't been discussed. So I keep that story very vague. And I haven't really even spoke about it for many, many years. I do give the first names of the two people who I was with. We all had different ways of coping with the captivity we had at that point. Greg, he was captured first, and Billy and I were pretty much running for our lives for quite a while, running through little villages, through people's homes, through their backyards, through the chicken coops, through the kids playing on the floor, going back on the streets with the people and the crooked police officers, if you want to call them that, chasing after us. Greg was caught first. We didn't know what happened to him. Billy and I, we rushed into this little, like, saloon-looking bar that was on this dirt road. I said, Greg, let's run in here. Let's calm down a bit. Let's just catch our breath. We ran inside, took a left, and there was a bar there, and we sat down. We're both out of breath. We're exhausted. It was really, really hot. And there were a couple of people in the corner looking at us very very intently, like, who the heck are these gringos in here? We're right. The only white people there.
Right.
And then there were a couple guys standing in front of us to the right. There was a door and a bartender. And the bartender said what we wanted. We just said water. And we're just trying to get our act together.
Sure.
We've been running for about 45 minutes, and we're exhausted. And we seem to have the whole town against us. And then I noticed that the people in the corner were kind of mumbling under the breath. And then some people stood at the doorway where we had come running in from.
Uh-oh.
So it looked like things were going to get really bad, and they did get really bad. What happened, I said, Billy, stand up, looking at the mirror in front of us. You can see the people behind us getting ready to come at us. I said, let's stand up and run out the door to the right front of the room we were facing. And we stood up, and before you know it, the people at the door, people in the corner of the room, charged at the two of us. I guess maybe five or six of them, probably five, pushed us against the bar and slammed us into the bar and ripped our hand up, took our arms and brought them beyond our backs and behind our backs, and they took chicken wire.
Oof.
And just tightly, tightly tied our hands behind our backs. Billy's hands behind his and mine behind me. And I thought for sure we were going to lose our hands. The chicken wire was in deep. It was just wire. And they're tying it as tight as they could so we couldn't get away. Then they lifted us both, and they threw us in the back of the bed of a pickup truck. And the pickup truck was steaming hot. The metal was really hot. And our skin was burning. And everything was looking really bad. And we were going down the road. It was bumpy. And there were checkpoints along the way, but these people, whoever they were, had permission to drive through the checkpoints. And I don't know how long it was we were back at that pickup truck, but I would assume it was about a 20 to 30 to 35 minute drive, maybe. And they stopped. It was really dusty and hot. And they came out and they lifted us up and they walked us into this little building, a little broken down building, which happened to be a jail cell. And inside there was, when you walk into the left, there was a guard sitting there in a uniform. And he just mentioned something in Spanish and he pointed. And he brought Billy and I into the cell on the left side of the hallway. And Greg was in there pretty much broken down already.
Oof.
And the three of us were in there. And all that was there was two bunk beds with wooden, they didn't have mattresses, just wood, plywood. And there was a bucket of black, dirty, greasy oil in the room with a lot of dead flies in it. And across from our cell, there was a cell with I don't know how many people, and it was just pitch black, but there were a lot of eyes we could see, just a lot of people, and it smelled terrible. I would guess there were maybe 15 or 16 boys and men in that cell next to us, across from us.
Wow.
So we were in there, and we really didn't know what was going to happen to us. We were in there. We weren't in there for a long time, but we were in there for just under 2 days, and we weren't eating, we weren't drinking. A transvestite guard came through, and there's a very manly-looking woman or a very womanly-looking man. I'm not sure, but I'm sure it was a transvestite, and he or she came walking in and didn't say anything but took that ladle that was in that black oily water with the dead flies in it and scooped up some black liquid and offered it to us to drink. And I said, don't even think about taking it. And we were all very thirsty and hungry, but we didn't touch that.
Yeah.
And then she took it, and she put it to the cell in front of us with all the kids and the boys in it and the men. And they all just grabbed it as quickly as they could with their fingers and tried to bring it to the lips to get something in their mouths. So we knew it was a bad situation. We didn't know how long those guys were in there.
Oh, God.
And we were in our own cell, which was good. But the three of us, we all had different coping mechanisms without knowing what was going to happen. And
if memory serves me, did you start to do exercises and push-ups and all that?
That's my coping mechanism.
That's what you went to.
Exercise.
Right.
Yep. And Greg and Billy, they had different coping mechanisms between crying and praying.
Right.
And
okay.
So it all worked for us, each of us. And you can never really put your mind in the mind of someone else. I'd also like to mention, when you're with the SEAL community, and I'll keep this very, very vague, you're not always with SEALs when you're working with people.
Okay.
So they're different communities, and they had different coping mechanisms. And but we all pretty much were facing the fact that it could be a terrible, terrible stay for us.
Did and again, like you said, and you're very right. And if you're just tuning in, today's guest, Don Mann, New York Times bestselling author, former member of Navy SEALs Team 6, and we're talking about his new book, Reaching Beyond Boundaries. And listen, I have never been in a situation even remotely close to that. Okay, and I'm just talking as you know, I'm the host of a radio show because I found the story fascinating. So these colleagues, whether they're SEALs or not, and I understand it's still not a declassified mission, so you're speaking vaguely, and I appreciate that. So with these other colleagues, and everybody has their own coping mechanisms, did it disappoint you as to how they responded?
No, it didn't.
Okay.
It didn't disappoint me. I really wasn't concerned on how they individually handled their own, whatever's going on in their minds. We all were scared.
Sure.
We didn't know if we were going to be executed or not. We didn't know how long we were going to be in there. And it wasn't for me to judge how they were going to handle their own fate. So I didn't judge that at all, by any means.
I understand. Again, we all cope in our own ways. Do you remember, or was there things that you were saying to yourself to get yourself through that? A self-talk, an inner dialogue?
I can say this, Tim. I've been in a bad situation a number of times.
Right.
I don't know why it is, and I don't know how I developed this or if I was born with this, but when things get really, really bad or there's a terrible scene occurring and I happen to be there,
right,
I seem to feel, I don't want to say comfortable, but I feel like that atmosphere or that situation for me, mm-hmm. I almost feel like my body and my mind calm down a bit and I'm able to take it in one step at a time and I don't panic and I think clearly. Now, of course, my thinking was, well, we could be executed, but
sure.
I think clearly. Of course, you're always looking for an avenue for escape. You're always trying to think of how we're going to get out of here. I never lost control. I never do lose control. I feel like I stay under control in those situations. And I'm sure a large part of that is the good training I had as a young SEAL. But I don't lose control. And I just, I have a positive mindset. Maybe that's a better word than combat mindset, but I have a positive mindset that things are going to work out okay. I just don't give up, and I think, okay, there's got to be a way out of this, but let's not stop thinking about a way out. There's got to be a way out. We can survive this. At the combat mindset, the definition we would normally use is everything's going to be okay. If you're in combat, you're not going to get hurt or wounded or killed. If by chance something does happen, you do take a round or you do get shot, you're going to survive because you're going to get good medical treatment. And if you survive, you're going to go to recovery and you're going to be okay. It's always an optimistic outlook. And then that is the definition in the military. What we use is combat mindset is everything's going to be okay. No matter what, everything's going to be okay. I pretty much sometimes relate it back to old rock and roll music when John Lennon would say, everything's in the end, everything's going to be okay. If it's not okay, it's not the end. And that's kind of pretty much how we look at combat mindset.
Right, right.